Much has been written about the contribution of Enlightenment philosophy to the development of liberal democracy, but what about the science of that time? Timothy Ferris visited our show in February to discuss his latest book, The Science of Liberty, which takes a fresh look into the origins of democracy and at what he describes as the relationship between science and political freedom. Mr. Ferris, who's an emeritus professor of science at the University of California, Berkeley, has also made PBS specials, contributed to numerous publications, ranging from the New York Times to Rolling Stone, where he used to work. His books about science include the bestsellers Coming of Age in the Milky Way and The Whole Shebang, which American scientists listed as one of the 100 most influential books of the 20th century. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed our conversation, and we thought that we would re-air it for you today. We started off by talking about the definition of a word that comes up a lot in the book, but which is often confusing because of its current political implications. I asked Timothy Ferris, how do you define liberalism?
I use liberalism in the original sense as the original political philosophy invented primarily by John Locke and a few others and embodied in the American Bill of Rights and in the British Bill of Rights a century earlier. It's a philosophy that people can be trusted to be free, and it's the basis of liberal democracy. A liberal democracy is just a government in which people can vote to do just about anything except abridge the rights of their fellow citizens. That's the liberal part. So there's
a difference between democracy and liberal democracy?
Yes, you could have an illiberal democracy. We just had a spasm of that in California when, as a state, people voted in a referendum to deny the rights of marriage to homosexuals. That's an assault on human rights, and that's not actually permitted under liberal democracy and won't, I think, stand in that state.
But we've had votes like that over and over again throughout our history in this country and elsewhere, where when the public is asked to vote on something that would restrict the rights of others, it's often said yes.
That's right, and that's why you have the courts and why you have a Bill of Rights. So the liberal part, I prefer to think rather than a left-right political spectrum, of more like, let's say, a diamond with the left and right on two corners and then liberalism at the third. It's an independent philosophy. You can be right-wing or left-wing and still be liberal. And totalitarianism as the opposite of liberalism.
How did science influence the Enlightenment philosophers who were devising democratic theories? Were they thinking about themselves in terms of science?
Yes, they were, of course. I think what science did was to put teeth in reason. You often read, when you read about where the Enlightenment came from, everything suddenly breaks down into a profusion of different philosophers. And the term often used is reason, but reason had been around for a long time, and you can reason yourself into quite unreasonable positions. The thing that changed was the discovery of science, dating from, let's say, around 1608 to 9 when Galileo started doing his observations, roughly around that time. And by science, I mean modern science, not just some lonely scholar guessing right.
Different from the science of the Greeks or the science during the Renaissance?
The Greeks had a little bit of science and a little bit of democracy. And there was some science and technology during the Renaissance. I use the term science to mean the whole social thing that we now have with professional scientists, journals, refereed conferences, all that. That social movement was made. That social movement inspired liberalism because the first thing that's clear to you about science and innovation is that you need to maximize people's opportunity to get in. You need the talent. You can't run science on a narrow base of just a few people.
You say democracy is similar to the scientific process.
Yes, in the sense that it's experimental, and it's experiment that's been overlooked here, I think, by many historians, because intellectual history tends to be about ideas, not about testing them. Science tests ideas through experiment. That was the innovation. And democracy does the same thing. As the physicist Richard Feynman said in a brilliant thing that I quoted in The Science of Liberty, the American system was designed so that you could govern even though you don't know how. You don't have to be an expert. You can try things. You can elect a brilliant president or you can elect a lazy simpleton, but you get another election. All these things will change. The one area where we could do better, I think, in liberal democracy is, although we pass laws that are experiments, and we have some feedback as to how they're doing, how these new measures do, we haven't always been anywhere near as good as scientists are at then adjusting our ideas accordingly and getting rid of programs that don't work.
So the Enlightenment comes along the same time as modern science is really burgeoning. But was this the new idea of science known by the general public, or was this limited to academics and philosophers? How democratic was it?
Well, in terms of knowledge, it was enormously widespread. Galileo's account of what he was seeing through the telescope spurred the creation of some of the world's first newspapers in Germany. And Newton's Principia was the best-known book in the world. I would really date the Enlightenment from around the time of the Principia.
Well, if liberal democracy comes out of science, does it work the other way? Do democracies nurture science?
Yes. I mean, when you look now back over 400 years of science, the vast majority, well, certainly over 90-some-odd percent of all the first-rate science that's been done in the world has been done in liberal democracies.
You know, the minute I read that, my mind, I always think of opposites. So there's the French Revolution, which grows out of the Enlightenment and then becomes very bloody. And yet really does encourage a whole new attitude towards science. We get the metric system and also measurements everywhere. There's been pretty good science that came out of Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union.
I can't think of one example, can you?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, rockets came out of Germany.
But rockets are thousands of years old. Germany was a scientific country. And it was also had been experimenting to a considerable extent with liberal democracy. In the late 19th century, Germany was the most liberal country on the continent. So when the Nazis came to power, they inherited a scientific establishment that had some momentum. But what they did was to run it into the ground. If you look at things like the citation rate of in scientific journals and so forth, it was a horrible effect that the Nazis had on science. They attempted to project an image that Germany was still in the forefront, and they had some success at that. The communists tried to do the same thing in the Soviet Union, and they both did it to some degree with rockets, which were just off the shelf. It was already available to use. So in my book, naturally, I wanted to look at those arguments, and when you look closely, you'll find that there just wasn't much there.
My guest is Timothy Ferris, whose latest book is called The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. It is published by Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, China has a growing middle class, but no real democracy. And yet one of the great new schools of science is located near Shanghai. I was just reading about it because there are fears now that we're also seeing hacking coming out of that university.
Well, we're certainly seeing some computer hacking, which is done by the government over there, fairly the same way the government does here, which is you just recruit kids who have done nothing but hack for years in their basements. I have a great love for the Chinese people, and the fact that they've joined the international economic community and managed to make the economic achievements that they have in recent years is wonderful to me. But I think that you should be able to make predictions, and based on what I say in the book, I would have to make the unhappy prediction that no matter how much money China spends trying to become a first-rate Chinese power, and despite the tremendous ingenuity and education and technical facility of their people, until they have a liberal democratic government, they will not be a first-rate scientific power.
Because it requires a free exchange of ideas.
Yeah, you can't have a government in which people are put in jail for saying stuff you don't like and expect to also have the kind of free exchange that nurtures first-rate scientific attainment.
We did see that in the Soviet Union when Stalin didn't believe in the Mendelian theory of inheritance, and so he just simply outlawed it.
That's right. The communist governments killed over 30 million people through state-sponsored famine alone. And I must say, speaking as a college professor, I get a little impatient with people who say that, oh, well, there's something to communism, it just wasn't done right. Communism ruled a third of the world, killed tens of millions of people. In my opinion, that's a sufficient experiment. It's over.
well, you're talking about Stalinism and Leninism. Those people are talking about some theoretical thing that would have been a different application of Marx, but we never have had it.
We've never had it, and hopefully we're not going to try it.
Well, let's talk about the United States, where we have had this experiment. And some of our early, the founding fathers were actually interested in science. I mean, I don't know how much Ben Franklin actually was involved in true scientific inquiry.
Benjamin Franklin was the greatest scientist in the Americas. He is an astonishing scientist. And among his practical achievements were things like the lightning rod. There were some divines in church circles who opposed lightning rods on the ground that God was deciding whose house to strike, but they didn't prevail, and a lot of lives were saved as a result of that one invention. Franklin was so popular, he's been turned into kind of a caricature, but it's worth going back and looking at who he was, because his influence is so great and because he was so scientific. Jefferson was another one. Washington was very interested in science. So much of my book is devoted to chronicling. One chapter is devoted to chronicling the importance of science in the founding of what they all called an experiment. Can a free people actually govern successfully? Jefferson at his...
And the word use of the word experiment, you're saying, suggests that they were thinking about it in scientific terms?
Yes, that's right. I mean, Jefferson at his second inaugural says, well, so far the experiment still... look at free speech. I've been criticized more... harmfully than anyone's ever seen. I've been pilloried in the press for 4 years, and yet not only am I still here, we've gotten reelected.
The amendment process is in a way similar to what happens in science, isn't it?
Yeah, the whole mechanism. I mean, another thing that democracy has in common with science is that it transcends individuals. Illiberal systems where you have one person with too much power require that you attribute to that person inhuman virtues. That's why the current leader of North Korea, for instance, can't just be a great politician. He has to write 100 operas and be the world's greatest golfer. You're put in a ridiculous position. Democracy, you don't have that problem. It's understood that people have failings. It'll work anyway.
Did you see that article in the New York Times Magazine a couple of weeks back, cover story about Texas board that chooses textbooks, and they are insisting that the founders were Christian and that this should be taught. It should be taught that America is a Christian nation. This sounds like the total opposite of everything you're saying.
Yes, well, it's false. I mean, they're right about the founders being Christian. Many of the founders wore powdered white wigs too. That doesn't mean that this nation is based on powdered white wigs. If you want to have science, you've got to have a secular democracy. You can't start enshrining mystical beliefs of any kind. And if you're a deeply religious person of one kind, you should want to keep the government out of that, because once the government gets involved, they're going to favor one religion over another.
But we have seen that, where free elections have brought religiously based parties to power. Hamas, for example. It would be more, in fact, if the dictators of Turkey, Algeria, and some other countries would allow free elections. People would vote in religious parties.
They might, and that would be a problem for a while, and it would be a long while. It's a dangerous step, but, democracy is always dangerous. I think you're better off taking a crack at it and seeing what will happen. I mean, if, for instance, Iran were to have one honest national election, which without question would sweep out its current leadership.
But it would still be religiously based. It just might be a bit more moderate.
It might be, or it might not. I don't know. I will say this about Iran, that Iran's a country that has the capacity to join the club, that is, to involve itself in real first-rate scientific research, to get to where you're not just a spectator. But to do that, they would need a secular government. They may not want a secular government, but they should just be clear that it's one or the other. You can get in the game or not. If being having a religious government is that important to you, that's fine. But know that you are choosing one fork in a road. You can't go both of them.
My guest is Timothy Ferris, whose latest book is called The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. It's published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with an interview I conducted in February with Timothy Ferris, who was on our show to discuss his book,
The Science of Liberty, one of the things we talked about was the book's subtitle, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. And I asked Timothy Ferris, are you linking all three?
Yeah, I must admit, I never care for subtitles myself. So it's the only words.
Are they forced on you?
They're not forced on me, but they're the only words in the book that I don't write. The laws of nature became a metaphor for the natural laws that we think of in terms of human rights. And that's kind of an invention, but the scientific idea is, well, let's see if it works. You know, suppose you conducted a society in which you protected these basic human rights and people got to vote and everything. And that experiment, of course, has been a success. It's been not only a success in terms of the fact that liberal democracies are the most stable form of government that's known, but also in terms of what's been done for the world as a whole. We have seen greater reductions of poverty and hunger and ignorance in the world in the last, 50-100 years than in all of prior human history, thanks to this combination of liberalism and science.
When you talk about science, are you talking also about economics?
Yeah, economics
considering
is a
fact it's a social science, but yes. We've been going through a rather tough time recently.
There are tough times, but I think you have to be careful about, there's a tendency, journalistically, and I speak as a sometime journalist myself, to overestimate these swings. We're having a rough economic time right now. I don't think it's all that difficult to trace the reasons why. Adam Smith, in his very first treatise on economics, made it very clear that you have to regulate markets to keep them free and fair, as he put it. And if you go in dogmatically and just keep cutting regulations on the dogmatic assumption that less is better, you will get real problems, and that's what we've got. But the problem is not the science of economics, which posted plenty of warnings down that road.
A listener, Paul from Manhattan, writes in, Newtonianism in the 18th century was really a very conservative tradition tied in with defending orthodoxy. No? I'm quoting, the Enlightenment led to liberal ideas, didn't it, and shaped Jefferson, who wasn't a Christian.
That's true. Jefferson was a deist. I don't know what he means about Newtonianism being conservative, but I would say again that I use the word liberal to mean what liberal really means. That's a philosophy of human rights, and it has nothing to do with whether you're conservative or progressive.
And in the case of Newton, his basic ideas work pretty well until Einstein came along and actually still work pretty well.
Oh, sure. You can get from here to the moon using Newton.
You write about how the spread of science, and you've talked about it here, and democracy has raised living standards. But we still have countries like India, which are great democracies, and an awful lot of poverty.
Well, the poverty is going down in India, and
it's taken a long time, hasn't it?
Well, I don't know. It's a huge country. These things aren't going to be solved overnight. But when you look at all these indicators, educational levels, literacy, health, lifespan, we doubled human lifespan in 200 years, which is an unbelievable accomplishment. And just the amount of money people have. I would like to correct one impression. All five quintiles, as the economists call them, each 20% group from the highest income to the lowest, have been doing much better over the last century than they ever did before. It's a real effect. You can't just explain it away by saying, oh, some people got really rich. I might add, by the way, that economic inequality across the world is not increasing, despite the fact that one often reads that. It's increasing here in the United States, not increasing around the world.
One of the great mysteries to me, anyway, is what happened in the Muslim world, which was at the forefront of science for quite a while, at a time when Europe was actually in the Dark Ages, and how this whole thing has reversed the way it has.
Well, there really wasn't any science back then as I would call science. There was court scholarship, and
But they had great libraries?
They had great libraries. They were terrific on the classics. They had great mathematicians. They had very little actual science. What you had were scholars, some of whom did work that we today, in retrospect, would call scientific. But the scientific process is a communal process. You have to have a lot of people doing it. You have to be able to kick ideas back and forth. It's a little misleading to go back in history and pick examples here and there and say somebody got something right. Those are proto-scientific. And there's certainly the Arab civilization we're describing was a high civilization. But there was nothing particularly scientific about it, and there was certainly nothing liberal about it.
Yeah.
Not quite nothing. I shouldn't go that far. But it was not inherently a liberal. It certainly wasn't a democratic society.
Every so often I get a book about how science education in America is in serious decline. I have heard those stories ever since I was a kid. And
yes.
Unfortunately, it meant that I had to take more science courses than I wanted to. Why are people more sophisticated about science in other countries? Or are we just fooling ourselves when we say that?
Well, it's hard to generalize about American education, and it's a black box to me, just as it is to many people. The wars that are fought over education are almost religious in their lack of empirical basis. We all know that there are right-wing conservatives who are angry about education and don't respect science. But there are also plenty of people on the left who don't respect science. The whole basis of progressive education is just assertions. There's no original empirical information to indicate that a progressive approach educated anybody better than the classical approach. So I'm in the same boat you are. All my life I've been hearing how bad our science education is, and it certainly has its problems. And when you talk to even sophisticated adults who have fancy college degrees, I find that at least half of them have no idea how to think scientifically. They don't know how to evaluate an idea. So they've kind of missed out on the last 400 years of history.
America still has become a leader in science despite all of this, partly through government funding. Is that still the case? Because one of the things we hear, we just recently did a segment on the new funding approach to NASA, and the NASA scientists are all really upset. And then all of our listeners wrote in and said, well, that money is better allocated to taking care of the problems right here in the United States.
Well, as far as the problems go, the countries historically, if you're doing well, if you're wealthy and you're doing science, you'll also have fewer of those problems. I mean, we don't have people starving to death in the United States. We have some problems. The way you attack those problems is not by doing less of the stuff that made you great in the first place. But NASA's an interesting case because it started off as this big government program, and it doesn't have a mission anymore, really, in the manned space program. So no one knows what to do with it. We built this space station. NASA funding is not going away. It's continuing at about $15 billion, which is a lot of money. There are some changes in how it's going to be spent. But, yeah, the way science is done now is more and more on tabletops. It's small experiments with a lot of intelligence, not necessarily a ton of money. And the number of areas where big government-sponsored multi-billion-dollar programs are really going to work are rather small.
Well, that's not totally true because, first of all, the NASA people said to us, you know, so many interesting things came out of the research for our space program that now are a part of our everyday lives. We should really consider that as part of the investment. But an awful lot of what we have spent money on has been on military, hasn't it? And the science that comes out of the military.
Well, so you mean aside from NASA, of course.
Yeah.
Because, these are... those arguments, it's not very effective. I mean, if you spend billions of dollars on NASA and you get Teflon, it's easier to just invest in Teflon. And military spending, similarly. I think it's always clearer to call things what they are and spend money on what it is. If you spend what you need on national defense, don't imagine you're spending it on something else. And NASA does a lot of things really well, and I think we'll continue to do so. But let's face it, we don't really know what to do with the manned program. No one solved that problem.
My guest is Timothy Ferris. His latest book, The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. It's published by Harper. Science can also be used to thwart democracy, can't it? Like monitoring dissidents.
Well, sure, technology can, but...
Oh, sure. Am I confusing technology and science?
Well, I think if you tap phones and set up infrared cameras to monitor dissidents, you could call that science. But science overall, you know, is not a neutral tool. It's not just something you pick up like an AK-47 on a battlefield. You could do that for a little while. But if you're going to nurture science, you've got to have a free country. And that's just empirically the fact. It's historic. It's a fact that emerges from the historical record.
Why are Americans so suspicious of science today? The polls indicate that we're not madly in love with scientific inquiry.
For two reasons. One, they don't understand it in large numbers. You know, at least half of Americans have no idea how science works. And two, it's powerful. So if you have something that you know has the power to affect your life and you don't understand it, it's naturally you're a bit fearful.
What about the other another aspect of it, which is the religious aspect? Many people see science as trying to prove things. Well, first of all, they see scientists as all being atheists, even though not all of them are, but also trying to prove things like evolution and the Big Bang, all sorts of things that go against their religious beliefs.
Well, that's, you know, that's tough. I mean, people learn stuff all the time, and if you don't like what they learn, that's your problem. It's not theirs. However, liberalism, I would point out, is the defender. It is the defender of religious freedom. The combination of science and liberalism does not threaten anyone's right to continue to practice any religion they like. Even if science somehow came up with an ultimate proof that every religion was false, that in a liberal country, that wouldn't affect anyone's ability to go to church.
This also leads to many people's belief that whenever you discuss something controversial, you have to present both sides. We've seen that with the climate change debate recently, where if I put somebody on the air who says, you know, I've watched the polar ice cap melt, I get a number of angry emails from people saying, well, you're not presenting the other side. I don't believe in global warming.
Well, they can believe what they like. Global warming scientifically is really simple. It's not a complicated matter. Evidence for the mechanisms of global warming have been just worked on independently by scientists dating back for two centuries now. It's hardly a new thing. And, as you know, we had this recent flap over some emails. So let me make an extreme statement just to clarify how science works. If the most famous climate scientist in the world were discovered via a YouTube video tomorrow to have been saying to his colleagues in private, aha, our plan to dominate the world by teaching them this phony global warming stuff is coming to fruition, the effect of that on the actual science of global warming would be negligible. It's not about people or their characters. By the way, the actual content of those emails is nothing much at all. But
well, it just proves that the scientists are human.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And some of them are rather thin-skinned.
That's right. We have two mindsets here. And if you are of a pre-scientific mindset, you tend to think that authorities have to be kind of perfect. But science and democracy aren't like that. Those are systems designed that ordinary people can make them work, even with all their flaws and foibles. So I think global warming does present a great opportunity for us to work on something on a global level. We have tremendous resources. The world spends almost $7 trillion a year on energy. So you divert just a little of that, you've got a lot of money, and that's and how you divert doesn't have to be to big government programs. But we should take it seriously, because if we don't, if we keep waiting, and we've lost at least a decade now, the costs of correction start to mount rather alarmingly.
Well, it seems to me that when people go out and buy hybrid cars or electric cars, they're doing it more during times when gas prices are high than they are because they really want to save the world. So how do you convince the Joe the plumber that it's in his best interest?
Well, one step would be to let gas cost what it actually costs. Our government subsidizes searching for oil to such a degree that George W. Bush complained about it. He had signed a bill, so I don't understand why we have to add more subsidies to drill oil when oil's already so expensive. Economists will tell you that a good first step is to remove market distortions and let people pay what things actually cost instead of having these artificially reduced gas prices here in the United States. In the long run, I think you'll see that a cap-and-trade system works best. It maximizes freedom, and it has the ability to start dealing with this problem.
If you said that before Congress, you'd have people screaming at you and throwing things at
you. Yes, but would I have a majority screaming at me and throwing things? I doubt it. I think, in fact, that's what will pass Congress.
So what do you see in the future? Is science just going to muddle through because we have a democracy? Do you see certain threats?
Yes, is my answer. There are always threats. But yes, I think we have, 46% of the people in the world now live in liberal democracies. The other half want to live in liberal democracies. Everyone wants the benefits of science, and many people are prepared to accept the minor sacrifices that might go along with getting it. Others don't want to, and they don't have to. We're headed in the right direction. We need to pay attention to what works. And we now have a lot of evidence of what works, what improves the human condition by every criteria that people everywhere would agree on.
Do you really think that's true, that everybody wants to live in a liberal democracy? Look at what's happened in Iraq. Look what's happening in Afghanistan, for example.
Well, I mean, there's no question the people of you're talking about Iraq. People of Iran certainly do. What I'm saying is that the public opinion polls show you that the overwhelming majority of people want to live in a democratic society. That's why even an organization like the Communist Party of China now has to say that we intend to become a liberal democracy when our people are ready, because otherwise it's just too unpopular a position. And I think there are people also in the party who honestly believe that. So what I'm saying is not based on speculation, it's based on polls. In Iran, for instance, the Iranians will tell you and have for years that the country they most admire in the world after their own is the United States.
Hmm. A listener says there's a big difference between science and industry. And are we confusing the two?
No, I'm just talking about science. We haven't really discussed industry.
But did America become such an important nation because of the Industrial Revolution? Was that a scientific boom?
Well, it's a big help to science. Because science is experimental, a lot of it comes out of individual experimentation. When you look at aviation, for instance, the aviation industry was created as a result of 150,000 different aircraft designs that were all built and flown by people who hoped to make a lot of money in the aircraft business. That's a terrific capillary or root system base, and that stuff really does, sure, it helps science. It's not, science doesn't just discover things and hand it down to industry. A lot of times it's barely able to keep up.
And then people started discovering new things for aviation. The Wright brothers insisted on their patent rights, and they set the whole thing back for a little while. There are these other factors, I guess. Those are the bumps in the road.
And patent is a fascinating one. That's why Thomas Jefferson established the patent office, because he could see that this was going to be a real fire line on this, and it has been ever since.
Timothy Ferris's latest book is called The Science of Liberty, a look at the relationship between science and democracy. In fact, the subtitle is Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. It is published by Harper. And I want to thank you for coming by again to talk with us. It's always a pleasure to discuss these things with you.
Thank you, Leonard. Pleasure to be here.